Okay, this is table four. Asia speaking. This is October 21st, Crispus Attucks Museum, and ready to go.
If you don't mind, I just have one question, and this is a problem that I have had being to the end, which is 4% black. I don't know the other ratios with other ethnic groups, but I put plays of, say, by the way, I'm Elizabeth Mitchell, documentarian, historian. I have a radio show that I anchor and co-host of. I wear many hats. Since I retired after 35 years in the Postal Service as the first and only black woman in Bloomington at the Postal Service. So I'm living my dream every day. I wake up excited since I retired, traveling the world, and doing what I can do to research, share black history by any means, except I'm not good at drawing. But I do everything else to get the word out. My question to each one of you, how is it to get blacks to support, engage black art? I have a play going on stage next week. All of my plays are to sold out audiences, white audiences. Big bars and still, I've even offered the school system, since they redlined and put most of the poor blacks into one school in Bloomington, free tickets, 100 tickets, to students and parents to come. Not one has taken up on it. So from each one of you, do you have that problem? Have you tried to solve that problem? That's what I want to be. Who wants to start?
I would like to. So my name is Christopher Newell, and I guess after this, we can do the introductions too. But basically, I would say to get more of a black audience, a lot of people my age hear a lot about a lot of different like black-oriented like gatherings or like concerts and things that happen in this area. But I think a lot of times being questioned and challenged on what that actually means to you, raising that first eyebrow, getting people interested, and what it actually is probably the first step. Because I think sometimes that with marketing and trying to get like exposure on something, you know, it's hard to like sometimes lead with this is like a black-led or black-owned thing, because that can also be a deterrence in some areas too. I don't know what it's like in Bloomington. I personally don't have a lot of great experiences in Bloomington. I'm not from here. I've also not heard a lot of great things about Bloomington either. So I would say that is a pretty challenging place to be in. But challenging how individuals feel about that, what does that mean for them? I think that finding that avenue or exploring that avenue is like maybe the first thing to look into.
Okay, so you think, from what you've heard of Bloomington, it's not a great place for people of color?
Not necessarily. Like, I know it's a college town because IU is there. There's like 40,000 students that go there. However, like, it's kind of not in the middle of nowhere, but there's not really much for black individuals there from what I heard. And from when I went there, the university is the only thing I've actually experienced. Like, when I've tried to find like a black-owned business, I think I found a couple, but there really wasn't like a lot. There wasn't like a lot of like anything screaming out black pride to me there. I would say the other thing too is like you have to drive through Martinsville, and that's probably the biggest thing that's like a deterrent, because I've had issues in Martinsville, stopping through there and whatnot. Like, I've been pulled over, like, just passing through to get to Bloomington twice. Yeah. I've also, I was selling a laptop online in Martinsville because a student who was going to University of Southern Indiana wanted to meet me halfway. Well, it's not really halfway, but he wanted to meet me closer to Indianapolis, but he didn't want to drive all the way. He doesn't know Indiana like that. And so he suggested Martinsville, and I'm like, well, I'm going to bring two friends with me. I did that. We stopped at a McDonald's to sell him a MacBook, and the workers at that McDonald's did not treat me kindly. And in fact, one of the workers like started issues with me, and the other two people that I brought with me had to like stand up for me, because like I felt like anything I said was a problem, or anything I called out was an issue. What was that?
How long?
This was actually 5 years ago. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm going to share that. There are black businesses, but we even created a black business book handbook.
Of course, nice.
Since the population is so small, it's not that many. But we do gather. There is a large, most of the people in the town, mm-hmm. we had a gathering place, but that's gone because gentrification, redlining, it's gone. It's been on the right side, we all gathered, it's gone. And those homes are $75,000 to $1,000, $75,000 to maybe $100,000 mm-hmm. in that area. They're now $300,000.
Wow.
Yes,
so I'm Samuel Levi Jones. I'm an Indianapolis resident, mixed media artist. And to answer your question, I think in terms of, you know, getting someone's interest, you have to maybe appeal to them in a way which something that they can recognize. You know, it's. I think generally speaking, if you're not outside of a large city where there's a larger sense of artistic culture, it's difficult. So I grew up in Maryland, and I had very little exposure to the arts, and I took a photography class when I was getting my first degree, and I was good at it, I enjoyed it, and that was my introduction to the arts. And I took classes that were sort of mandatory in school, but it didn't appeal to me. And I think that, you know, we have to provide a broader sense of there has to be an introduction. You know, so I've been visiting home, Marion, quite a bit, because I'm working on a project there. And there's a young lady there who owns a gallery, a black woman, and she's teaching an art class at one of the middle schools, Tashima. And you know, she was talking about the first day of class, she said to some of the kids, the art teacher's black. And so I think, you know, that sort of, you know, and growing up in a town where, you know, most minorities, there were very few minorities that have blue collar working positions. So you kind of identify with what you see, if you will. And have an understanding of the possibilities only through what you see. And it wasn't until I left Marion, I think, got involved in the arts and, you know, was in places like Chicago or California and seeing people of color who are, you know, physicians, lawyers, and so on and so forth. So you have to create a space where young people can understand that there's a possibility. And so, you know, it's interesting, I think, so this, I've been thinking of, it never came to fruition, but thinking about the All-Star Game that's happening here in Indianapolis this February. I was thinking about the idea of putting together an art exhibition that sort of appealed to the culture of sports, if you will. Because I don't think it's not simple people of color, but like in rural America, there isn't access to arts. So rather you're white, black, whatever, you don't have access and it's not part of your worldview, you're not going to have an interest in it. And there, you know, there are a lot of professional athletes or former professional athletes who are serious art collectors.
Yeah.
And then so, you know, for a demographic who pay attention to sports, and they may have an understanding or see these athletes who are collecting art and they're serious about it. I have the potential to grow a cultural shift. So yeah, I think it's providing a way that one can identify with something in order to have that connection.
Hi, I'm Sierra Johnson. I'm a mixed media artist. So at the Harrison Center, I help run a program with the Great Tree Arts. And one of the ways we've been successful is by including them in the development of stuff. So instead of bringing them finished programming, everything we do, we ask them about it from like the onset, from the jump. So that way, they're already invested in the project even before it comes to stage or to the gallery. It's already theirs, and then that makes them want to show up even more or invite their friends, family, grandchildren to said event. So kind of engaging them at the beginning is a good way, especially if people don't have access and they're not arts-minded. If they can kind of discover it along the way, then they'll be more apt to participate in the finished product because they're that builds anticipation and right they're already like emotionally invested. They want to see it succeed.
Right.
I also want to add, being that you're a woman, so I spent a lot of time there recently. In the process of last year, I was in a artist in residence program there at the school, finishing it up. But at the museum, the Eskenazi Museum, they actually have, you know, I think sometime last year there was an exhibition on women artists, and a lot of artists in there were artists of color. And I think generally speaking, with universities, they're, you know, very siloed. So there's the Black Cultural Center there. I don't know exactly what it's called, but it's right next door.
Neil Marshall Black Cultural Center.
Yeah, and I think that they're not aware of the programming and the exhibitions that happen in the museum. You know,
and it should be, because there was a black female director, Joy Cooper. Her husband was in music and was worth five Grammys. So that's, I think, since the time I've grown up in desegregation, there's a disconnect where at one time we all knew what everybody was doing. We all participated and we all went out to support. Now we're split out. It's just that disconnect, and there's no gathering place. There's no place. The international recorder doesn't come down there. I don't know if it's online now, but we don't have like even an online place to go to. We've been talking about it for the last 2 years. How can you connect with that community that's all over London or County?
And even on campus, just getting students in the museum. But I've had lots of conversations with them about, you know, breaking down those walls, and particularly getting students into the museum and, you know, seeing what's going on. But a museum, even though it's broad, they don't have like a broad.
This is a little place.
Yeah, I mean, it's like they have a great collection. It's not diverse, if you will, but they're really, you know, expanding the collection, and they're very intentional about it. You know, and working with the individuals that I've worked with. So there's opportunity, there's possibilities, and there has been lots of change, just sort of getting over the hump.
I'm surprised that they have that problem with students now getting city folk, the residents, over. There's always been a great divide of town and down. Parking is a problem. And most of the black residents, that 50% are older, we're not going to park 2-3 miles away and walk in. That's for the students. So that's an issue. We just don't take it back. I don't go. I go to the, if I'm around and available, to the Black History Center for their events and try to support that. Fraternities and sororities, they do something. But other than that, I can care less to go over to IU, because I know IU's history hasn't been all that great. It hasn't been great, period. So that's problematic too. And I know they're working on it, and I know things are slow to change.
I've been back here for 6 years now.
Yeah, things are slow. It's excruciating slow. Yeah. And I'm 70 and I can't do slow right now.
Yeah.
I'll say, here's the, I don't know where you want to start. That's the questions on the card. And then you just pick a card and we go.
Okay, let's go with this one. Oh. Fun.
Sierra, did you introduce yourself?
Yes, I'll say it again. My name is Sierra Johnson, and I'm a mixed media artist working out of the Harrison Center. Discuss whether public art should be censored within the context of the controversy surrounding Fred Wilson's unrealized E Pluribus Unum sculpture.
Tell me about the sculpture.
Yes, tell me.
Do you know about it?
No.
I don't know about
it either.
Do I need to Google it?
I know about it.
Okay.
Okay.
So, and I know Fred, like I don't know Fred really well. It was probably 2009, I believe, he first came to town and to talk about this potential project that he was going to do. And so part of Fred's practice is just sort of reimagining things. And he has this project that he's done called Mining the Museum, I believe is what it's called, that he goes into the museum archives and he curates objects that are sort of problematic to people that that may have been exhibited or shared in the past that don't come out, so maybe like a plan, a costume, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the project, so downtown on the circle, the Soldiers and Sailors Monument, there's a figure, a slave figure that's sort of sitting subservient to white figures holding up the shackles. And he was going to recreate that figure, and instead of the figure holding the shackles, would be holding the flag of African diaspora. It was going to be placed in a cultural tribe. And a lot of people were opposed to that project on both sides. This goes back to what I was talking about earlier with the question that you asked about the issue of the lack of exposure to the arts. So if you can't get someone in a gallery space, if you can't get them in a museum, you know, I thought about how, what it would be like to be a young person and sort of like just walking down the street upon that, reading a didactic and getting an introduction to the arts, if you will. And that was the positive that I saw in the potential of that project, but it was shot down and it never happened. And I've talked about that project quite a bit. It's really interesting that that was a full question.
I think we live in America, the land of the free, supposedly. And I don't believe in banning books or banning art or banning anything of any kind. Because if you have done some art that I don't like and I don't care for, I don't go see it. But don't tell me I can't go. I don't want anybody to tell me I can't do something. I lived through that as a child. I'm not going back there. And I try to live a peaceful life. And I can handle anything you throw at me, because you can't throw anything new. But if you're going to throw it at my grandkids, different story. Not happening. So because I lived through segregation in Indianapolis, where I couldn't go to the Circle Theater, we had one show, Matt and Walker. All the black kids, we walked in a group, walked over here. We walked on the other side to Douglas Park to go swimming. We had one place to go for skating rink. We were told, no. Riverside had a theme park, one of the first theme parks in the country. I couldn't go. So I don't want anybody telling me I can't do something, because then I'm going to do it. In the land of the free, everybody ought to have those opportunities to see, do, and read whatever the hell they want to. That I'll fight for. And if it means somebody's got to die for me to do that, so be it. That's me.
I'm still processing what you said, right. So I don't know how to
chewing on it. I mean, when it comes to public art, I think the purpose of art is to stimulate thought. So I think when something is controversial,
yeah,
right, it is supposed to challenge you. I don't think, like, because I'm an artist, I'm right. I'm like, I don't want anyone telling me what to do. I think a question in public art is, besides challenging you, like, is how are we using public art? Are we using it to challenge, to do, to challenge status quo and all that kind of stuff? Or are we using it to, like, just enforce whatever the state values are? I mean, it's very easy to put up, right, we're in Indiana, to put up a bunch of signs that say that Indiana is a state that works. But that's just to tell you that it works. It doesn't actually ask any questions about the kind of work that's being done and who it's working for. So I think when you have something like this, E Pluribus Unum, you know, kerfluffle, that really starts to, like, let you know, like, who's trying to use art for what. And I think that's an important, like, discussion that needs to be had, right? Not just amongst artists. Definitely amongst artists, but also with the public in general. What are they looking for from public art? Like, because a lot of people aren't looking to be challenged. They're looking to be comforted and, like, just feel good about whatever's happening. And so then when you have something like this, it rattles them.
I didn't do an introduction. My name is Christopher Newell, and I am a local Indianapolis photographer. I think to, like, piggyback off what you were just saying, intention is everything. And I think especially with art, it's a really hard place to be, especially as a colored individual, just because I think that, dating back to my experience, I had took, like, a African studies class at IUPUI, and the woman who taught the class said that if you're black and you're an artist, you should be a committed artist, being that, like, you should make art about blackness or black experience. And that, she was black, yeah. And I thought it was pretty interesting because, like, going into the Heron School of Art and Design, like, I didn't really know. I was still trying to find, like, my artistic voice and, like, what I thought making art, like, what am I gonna spend my time making art about? And so when she said I had to be a committed artist, I was just like, well, then does everything else not matter? And what does that mean? And intention has been, like, such a thing that I've been kind of challenging for myself, but also challenging, like, my perspective on other artists. So I think it's great that, like, this is the question asked, because it's very interesting to see, like, how much you can change someone's perspective putting up something that's controversial that could be very personal to you or non-personal, and so down the rabbit hole. But yeah,
I kind of beg to differ sort of on the commentary of that professor.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, it's disappointing that we have that sort of that is an expectation, and it's, you know, from an individual standpoint, any given individual standpoint, you know, a person should be able to create from whatever means that they feel that they need to create.
Yeah.
That's putting one in the box, if you will. And if one feels compelled to make work in a certain way, that's what they should do. So going back to what you're being told about, you know, being told what to do and not to do.
Don't want
to
do it.
Yeah.
Been there and done it.
Yeah.
That got old.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring up a point, and I thought I was going to fall out of the chair when you mentioned it, since I was here earlier.
Okay.
For the historian part of this. And I found out something I did not know.
Okay.
That monument downtown with that specific piece. I don't know if you're all aware, Indiana was supposed to be a free state that was only on paper. Indiana did not want black people here at all, period. It was supposed to be a white state. They made it free on paper so that slave owners could not bring slaves here because they just didn't want black bodies here.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of underground railroad stations to keep you moving, to pass through. Don't stay. We don't want you. Keep going. we will help you keep going. Then his back started to settle anyway, because the law's changing in North Carolina, because they knew he was free. And that any free people of color were going to become slaves in North Carolina. So with the Quakers, they came here and settled. Most black settlers, which there were a lot in Bloomington, they kind of mirrored the settled here in the Quaker group. Well, then they had to pay money and sign the Negro registers and go through all of this. And then at one point, Indiana, you know, they helped create Liberia. We will give you $50, $100, get out. We don't want you. But they came anyway. But that particular piece of that statue, I don't know what side it was on, but a guy said it is because of slavery not being here, and so many slaves are running here. White men made their money, a lot of money, catching slaves. So what you talked about, oh, here it is, dedicated to the South. The monument is dedicated to the South, and that piece is of a man being held down, the shackled man, to the slave catchers came to get. That's what that indicates. And I did not know that, the history of that.
Wow.
So when you mentioned that monument, you started like, oh wow, I've heard it twice about that monument. So there's probably other things about that monument I haven't taken the time to really do the history of. And I guess there's a museum inside. There's so much work to be done. That just wasn't on my radar. Because they're not going to take it down.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I just wasn't going to worry about it. But I thought it was interesting that today it was mentioned twice. Once this morning and you mentioned it.
Right at the heart. Man. Wow.
So, anybody want to pick another card?
Oh. Who else would you like to see at one of these tables? What would their voice contribute to the conversation? I want to see Mike Epps at this table. Because I just believe it or not, I've ran into him so many times.
Really?
Like, yeah, probably like 8 times. Mostly because I worked at the Apple store and he'd come in and we'd crack jokes or whatever. Hey, Chris, that Chris, go here, man. I got an iPhone, need to return. My wife ain't grateful. No, I'm kidding. But,
does he live here?
Yeah, he still lives here.
He and his wife are doing some housing projects. They're doing something to put back.
Something like that. I think, I don't know where his show is being filmed, but it might be here. It might not. But yeah, I know he lives here. And so it's just interesting because I think a lot of his colleagues, people he's acted with and worked with, like they're either back, like living in California, they're living in a different country, whoever he's like acted with. And so it just kind of begs the question of like, why are you still in Indianapolis? Like there's so many conversations, you know, like, we've had, and at the historian meeting earlier today, there was a lot of conversation about like Indiana trying to keep people here. Mm-hmm. I think Indiana has a lot of great things, especially for the people that are getting kicked out of the West Coast, like all the people of California who have money, who are now, you know, the gentrification stuff you're talking about, like they can afford those houses, so they're going to go and buy that, plus add 2 or 3 acres, yeah, you know. And so Mike Epps is one of those people that's like, great, you're here, we get to keep you, but like, why? And so I think he just would have a lot of interesting things to say, or at least I would find him interesting.
I find that interesting that you brought that up, because here again at our table number one, one of the persons sitting there said he would like to see Mike Epps, Babyface, Vivica Fox.
Yeah.
I think the other one person died somewhere. But all of those artists that came from this area to create an endowment for more artists, to create something for kids, whatever that endowment would encompass, but they have the funds to get together and do that.
Yeah.
And compared to living in California, it would be a piece of cake for some money. They specified exactly what I'm going to do, if it's for the arts or maybe a portion of of it's for the arts and portions for this, but it's all about the youth. And then again, and I thought, oh man, that's a great idea. So again, Herb isn't mentioned. But I think he is doing something about housing. So even though we'd like to tell people what they should do with their money, whatever he decides, as long as he's giving back, I'm cool with that. But I think it's really important to give back, even if you don't have enough. I think of the story in Florida of a washerwoman, give a little bit of her money, and then he created a university. Somebody that still exists today. She didn't have any money. This was during a time she couldn't do nothing but wash people's clothes. And so everybody could do a little bit of something, but certainly if you've got a lot like they have, then I'd like to see a chunk of that. Just help the youth out. Because the youth from when I was growing up, things has changed so much. We had so many rules to abide by. And now it appears to me everything's kind of loosey-goosey. If we had helped them focus on what they need to do. And like I said earlier, growing up in segregation, it was great for me. I was grounded from that. I have, you know, my ethic, my work. And I was surrounded by love. I didn't know hatred. I didn't know about racism. And it was wonderful. And to get out in that world, and your parents didn't tell you anything. You just experienced cold turkey, and you had to learn to toughen up, get tough, or we figured the world would eat us. So you had to change a little bit. I used to cry all the time. I'm crying. Somebody gonna cry, but it's not gonna be Liz. And that's from experiences.
Yeah.
I had to change to make it, to survive. So I like our kids, if they understood what it's like, that togetherness, and not to knock integration. I think that's really important, because what I went through to integrate schools, kids now enjoy that. The problem is they think the playing field is level. They don't know. It's not. It's still not.
I have one thing to add on. Actually, two people to add on to this list. My parents. I want to see them at this table. I think that they would be also would be very interesting to see what they would say. And it's sad because I don't know what they would say. Not really. So I know they're not like artists, but in this situation at this table in this building, like having these types of conversations, like I'd never really had them with my parents. I was told by my mom to toughen up and not by my dad. Dad's white, mom's black.
Yeah.
You know, it's very like, they didn't really have a whole lot to say or stand up for me. Dad, what do I do when someone calls me an Oreo? Just ignore him, son. I mean, you know, that's what we do. I'm like, no, that's what you do. What are you talking about? My skin is dark, hold on. So it's, yeah, so, and you know, my mom's in the corner like, just beat him up. I don't know. Like, beat him up. Great. Now I'm going to be the angry.
Flip a coin.
Yeah.
Flip
a coin.
I kind of nice to son between the two.
Mm-hmm.
As long as no one puts their hands on you.
Yeah.
Words don't mean nothing. They call you N-word. So what? Tell them to find another one. That don't mean nothing.
Oh,
but if
man.
They put your hands, and in the school I sent him to, they said, Mrs. Mitchell, you can't tell him that. He lives in a different world. If you touch me, it's on. I'm going to whip you. But if you're talking, talk on. No problem. In word, okay, I'm one. My granddaddy's the same as your granddaddy. He love ends. And you see she people shut up then. He love
Oh man, hey, I would have broke my neck looking at you if I heard that the first time.
Come see my play if you want to see me really act up.
Yes, yes.
I'm doing women's suffrage and all about women's rights next weekend.
Nice.
Telling it like it is. Telling some stories about Susan B. Anthony that my white audience is going to get a year full. But I get their money first. They buy tickets first before they walk out.
So who would you like at the table?
Oh, man. Well, since I'm doing this show and talking about many subjects, I would like to bring back Susan B. Anthony. Explain to me, since I found out a lot of stuff doing the research for this play, and then Frances Harper. I'd like to see the two of them together interact about women's suffrage and women's rights and healthcare rights for women. All the stuff that we're battling today, it was battling the same stuff 100 years ago. So we stepped forward and then we ran back.
What do you think that might look like?
I'm not really sure, but you know, unless they know, unless they do their homework coming from their era and do the homework, what's going on now, all they can talk about is what they know. And what they know, Susan B. Anthony, you know, they wanted to put it on some money. They really celebrate her as great women's suffrage, and her friend, Katie Stanton, Elizabeth Katie Stanton, helped slaves escape. They stayed in her house and all of that. So many of these women were celebrated. But they wanted rights for white women. And they wanted it before they got it. And they said it was better for you to be enslaved by an educated white man. That's best for you than by ignorant black men. Ignorant men, black men are ignorant. They're not ready. We're smarter than that. Give it to us first. And that's not in anybody's history books. They didn't want that out. Well, when I put something together, I give talks. I put it out there, the good and the bad. Yeah, she does some great things, but did you know about this? And I actually turned to the audience and said, do you know about this? We will talk about it. And everything I do is pretty much in the teaching mode, so that you come away with something you didn't know. And I always do teams, always, so that we can have a conversation. My husband is a retired policeman. He's at every stage, so you acting crazy. And he's a big guy, and he doesn't say anything. He's that quiet, deadly type. So look. So he had to put your hand, you don't say nothing, just be quiet. Because a couple times he's asked to ask people to leave. Oh, I find that white men want to fact check me. They got their phones out. And I was talking about the Slave Act. There were several of them passed. This guy says, well, I knew about that one. I don't know about this one. I said, you think I'm lying? I'm standing up here. I don't know what I'm talking about. And he goes, oh, yeah. And then he wants to show me. I get that, too. So when that happens, I try to.
It's the look that gets me first. It's the glasses halfway down their nose. They're like looking at you, looking at their phone. And their phone's massive. And they're like, yeah, I found it. And I'm like, okay, bud.
And then go show me. I just told you, but you go.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
I used to get that look at the Apple store all the time whenever I tell them something new that their device can do, or like the history of something.
They don't believe you.
Yeah, no.
So if you're white, they would believe you. You think that?
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Now, why do you think that is in this day and age? Is it because of your hair?
I think it's a multitude of things. I think that my speech is a part of it. Like, if I sound like them, it's like, oh, you think you're inquisitive. You think you know what you're talking about. I'll make sure I put you in your place. And then when it turns out I'm right, like, that sucks. It's also kind of like an ego, like, diminisher a little bit. I think another thing, too, is the hair as well. I think my experience, if that is brought out in conversation as well, I think that's also something that's like, really? Like, I think that's like, well, now that I know that you experienced this, then there's kind of like this, what is it called? There's kind of like this expectation that's then made in their head about me, and like all these different things that I should know or not know, or and vice versa. I think the only time I wasn't challenged in that light was when I was working at Salesforce, surprisingly, and it's not really like a big, like, diverse place to work, so it was also, it was just very interesting. But when I was at Apple, it was just a lot of that. A lot of executives would come in And they would like want to buy like 50 iPads, and I'd tell them about it. They're like, yeah, is your like manager or something around? Oh, my manager sent me to sell all these to you and talk about how it's gonna work for your business. Really? Why is that? Because I'm qualified. Oh, well, you don't have like a leadership or anything. I'm like, is what I'm telling you not proficient enough, or do you just not like that I'm telling you? Like, I just want to know, because I got like 5 years under my belt, and I've been like, I'm gonna sell another 70 after you leave, so it doesn't matter if you get it from me or not. But yeah, this is very interesting.
Do people want to touch you?
Oh, that's definitely happened. Yeah, I've had like, it's usually old white women that'll walk up and they're like, they don't ask, they just walk up and touch, and I'm like, excuse me, are you okay? Like, why are you touching me? She's like, I used to date this black man in 79, he was beautiful. I'm like, and is he still alive? Does he have hair you can touch? Why am I being touched right now? Like, it's...
Have you ever tried to do it to them? Just be like...
I kind of want to avoid jail.
I mean...
But fair.
I've had people do that. You know, like I told you, when I hired at the post office, I was the first black and only... In fact, I was the only black woman the entire time I was there.
Oh, yeah.
When I first got there, I had to say, I get mad quite a bit, do not touch my hair. Well, one girl snuck up behind me, and she gasped, and everybody turned around, and she said, it's soft.
Oh, my goodness.
And another thing that would piss me off, don't touch my hair, but do not touch my son's hair. Do not touch my grandson, because I'll smack your hands off. That is offensive to me.
Yeah.
Touching up the hair. But I think I told you my husband is very, very fair.
Yeah.
Well, and he's got what we'd say good hair. Mm. A lot of people, and I like that too, and he does that now too. In fact, I cut all mine off. Hair's overbraided, I don't want it anymore. But people would come up to him, black or white. What are you? I've been looking at you, what are you? When we travel, I travel the world, we've been everywhere. What are you? And so my husband doesn't answer. And the old British guy kept standing there, and I'm watching him. And I'm thinking, I know what he's thinking. I didn't ask you something, you're not asking. My husband never would just look at you. And finally the guy walked off. But he stood there, he had asked that question, and he expected an answer, and he wasn't getting it. And he wouldn't move.
You know, I've heard this, I've heard it through a friend, and I've heard it recently, and that the idea of answering a question with a question. And so I get that from all different.
Yeah, he does too.
And I think a lot about how I may change that to a else. It's really interesting that in our society, just like the human makeup, is that we have this way in which everything needs to be defined. There has to be a category.
So I can feel comfortable. So I know where you are.
You have to identify. I think it's like, what's so wrong with like not identifying? Just like being a mystery or whatever.
Now, one time he did ask a black woman, and she kept insisting, and he said, why is this so important to you? Well, I just gotta know.
When I think in a situation like that, you realize that you're sort of perpetuating the problem. It's like, also opposed to that. That woman is perpetuating.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, the question with a question, or just answering something that would be unexpected. Like, I know that one of my grandmother's friends, she was very fair-skinned, but she was, like, her parents were pretty fair, too, but she was mixed. And when people would ask her, like, what she is, she's like, oh, I'm a Christian. And they're just like, oh, that's not really what I meant, but that's all you need to know. And I'm I'm like, okay, wow. So, I mean, I haven't found out an answer for myself, but you know, it's
about sort of shifting the power that
I like that. I had someone tell me when my son was little, Liz, you make sure he marries within his race. And I said, I will. I'll make sure he marries somebody in the human race. Yeah, but I was told that by an older white lady. Make sure he marries in his race.
Oh, man. That just reminds me of my girlfriend's grandmother. She automatically assumes that, like, we want kids the whole nine yards. Not really planning on it right now, so, you know, whatever. But she's just like, oh, so what does your boyfriend look like? Found out what I looked like before she met me. She's like, oh, I feel so bad for the grandkids. And I'm like, oh, that's cute. And her friends also said that, too. And I'm just like, well, yeah, I mean, I don't really know, like, if you want me to give a response to that or you want me to acknowledge that you said that. But it's also just very interesting, like, when people put you in a box, like we were saying, like, immediately they already think they know what they're going to get, what they're going to have, the XYZ. I remember one time I was working at the Apple store and I had the afro I was telling you about, huge, like, really, like, 60s, late 60s, early 70s,
yeah,
huge.
Love that look.
Yeah, yeah. And, I had but it was so, like, I didn't have a pick, there was a lot going on with it, so I put a beanie on, and there was an old white couple that mistakened that as, like, a turban, for whatever reason. I asked them if they needed help, and they were like, no, we didn't need your help. They walked away, and then my managers were like, you didn't check on her? Like, go check on her. Like, ask her if they need help. I did. She said she needed my help. Okay, go ask again. So I go, and same answer, and then, I was like, did I do something? Is there something wrong? Because the way she said it, I, like, called out her tone of voice in the matter. And then she started to get loud, and she's like, I don't want your help. They walk away. The couple walks away, goes over to one of my white employees, and they're asking for help. And she's busy. She's like, well, looks like Chris is available. I don't want Chris's help. Yeah, yeah. Well, so here's what happened. The black manager, senior manager, walked up. To me, asked me about the situation, and we walked up to them together. He's like, yeah, so is everything okay? Like, you know, did Chris do something wrong? We just don't want his help. And I was just like, this is so dumb. Like, immediately, I'm just like, they have something against black people. Take off my hat, and I'm like walking away, because I'm like, I'm going to go on my 15-minute break. And she's like, oh, wait, is that an afro? Oh, I thought you were Muslim. Sorry, sweetie. I'm just like, that makes it better? Then he told her to leave the store. She's like, no, you gotta leave. Yeah, you gotta leave. Because she wasn't given any type of answer up until that moment. I'm just like, this is so sad. Like,
I had thought you were Muslim.
Yeah, I had a big beard too. Like, yeah, it was.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Who would you like to see at the table? Would you have a. You can pass.
No. I'm always interested in who's financing art. So the people who pay for exhibitions and things, I would like to ask them some questions. No. or know them so they can finance me.
Yeah.
I think that's an important conversation to have, especially when you're trying to get, like, community engaged in the arts. I don't even want to use that word, like, community, but, you know, underprivileged or whatever the terminology you want to use. If you're trying to bring arts to those communities, then you definitely also want to be talking to the people who pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because kind of from the first question, it's a question of, like, what the art you're choosing to display, what are you using it for? Are you using it to challenge, to cajole, or using it to, like, reinforce, like, pre-existing notions?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always interested to know, like, where the money comes from and how it got there. So I think that's an important part of it, especially I'm trying to make a living as an artist. And so that's an important part of the conversation for me. But I think I love all your points. I like listening.
No.
I mean,
I find with what I do with stage work, my financing comes from white organizations. A lot of the churches in Bloomington now have formed racial justice task force. Black churches don't support us. financially. A few of them come out, but the base of finances for me come from white churches or just white people. That's why I helped restore the colored church in West Baden, Indiana. The last structure in the whole county that from the African American community that made that community wealthy. French Lick, West Baden predated Vegas, and everybody from all over, gangsters, everybody, came there on the train.
Which hotel?
The West Baden Hotel.
Well, one block from that hotel.
I don't think so.
Is that out. Church? Yeah, one block, and that community made these guys wealthy. Made the whole community, and they all left. Well, who's there now? Our island. The islands or doing service work.
Okay.
So I did a story. In fact, I just had a premiere there at that hotel a few months ago.
Okay.
And it's one more show it here at Indiana Landmarks in February. So, and I'm talking about restoration of the church, but there was so much to talk about individuals in that black community and how intelligent they were. And it was too much to tell. West Baden Colored Church has been in the news and magazines and everything, especially since I was working on restoration. So part of the job I did, other than research, and then I did most of the photography and videotaping, was interviews and fundraising. And my money was white money. One guy, he was pissed about the sign. He said, they've renovated West Baden and French Lick. I don't know if you knew that. Bill Cook renovated those two towns. They were in the ground. West Bay Hotel, birds and animals were living in it. It was, you know.
I've been there, I've seen that.
So he renovated both towns, everything except
the church.
The church. Mm. So this one white guy, he said, did they not renovate that because it says First Baptist Colored Church? Well, I'm pissed. How much money do we get? And I go, whatever you want to give. Every time I ran low on money, he would call me and give me $10,000.
So
like he
done?
Was giving me candy.
Is it
it's done.
Is it?
You ever heard of Teddy Pendergrass?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely.
His cousin is preaching down there at 11 o'clock every Sunday.
Okay.
Robert Pendergrass.
Mr. Soul himself.
Now, Robert don't sing that good, but he kind of.
Okay.
11 o'clock Sunday, if you're not doing nothing, head down that way, and you'll meet Robert Pendergrass, and that's who's holding services there.
Listen, my grandmother loved Teddy Pendergrass so much, I would have thought that man was my grandfather.
And he could have been.
He could have been. It was crazy.
Anybody want to pick another card? We've got two. I don't know how much time we have left.
Yeah, 7 minutes. Oh, man.
Yeah, the church is beautiful. I'm proud of it.
Wow. And it's West Baden?
West Baden.
B-A-D-E-N.
Yeah. Oh, Baden, because it's taken from Germany.
Okay.
West Baden, and they have the hotel. There's a lot to do there now, so go ahead and walk around and check it out. But please go by the church. It's open every
the
Sunday.
The hotel's kind of like the Titanic.
Yeah.
Wow.
A lot of artists went down to do renditions of the church. I've got, they give me all these pictures, if you want this, of the church. It's beautiful now. From where I, when I first stepped into it, because it wasn't going to make it. It was falling into the ground. And now it's up and running.
Nice.
You can do that.
This question is, what type of public art has had the biggest impact in Indianapolis? What type of public art has had the biggest impact in Indianapolis?
Whoever did that love sign? Mm.
Robert
Who was
Indiana.
That?
Robert Indiana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
That's a big one.
Yeah. I mean, there for a while, that was, everybody did that.
Yeah, that's like,
I can't think of any other artists. Wait a minute. Written art. Kurt Vonnegut.
Well, this is public. So that would. Yeah.
The downtown murals of like Marnie Evans and Major Taylor. But I, when you first asked the question, I thought of the 18 mural on the street in terms of like impact, like more things happening after that. That's one that I remember, like in my recent memory, that's like from my like adulthood. It's like that whole set of events has kind of changed culture in Indianapolis. Like there wasn't any black art stuff. Like if there was, of course, because there always is, but not like you go from like moments to like a movement and a concentration like then. Like everyone starts paying attention and it's that moment.
I mean, and that goes back to the importance of public art. Yeah. Because it's the visibility. And increases in experience.
I think the mural on the Stutz building of like Mike Epps is also on there too. But the other individuals I unfortunately can't think of off the top of my head, which is I think kind of like something that's part of the point too. Like if you don't recognize them and they're like on a spotlight, like who are they? Why are they important? And I think that that's like an intention piece. And for me, that's just like, oh, okay, like these people are probably from Indianapolis too, and they've brought like a significant like amount of value to the city or to the culture here in some way, shape, or form. So I think like, you know, also just kind of knowing how that plays into plays into your experience of like you being Indianapolis residents and the story that you get to tell when you travel their places or people come to visit you, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I'm not going to use these cards because you brought up something that thought about me. Like I haven't been here in Indianapolis for 45 years, but I like the murals that I see growing up, especially if they're depicting African Americans, because that's what I'm all about. Tell me about the street work when they did the Black Lives Matter, right in what was the heart of the black downtown. Somebody comes from somewhere, they didn't like it, to destroy it. That just, I still can't get over that.
Yeah.
It wasn't bothering them, it wasn't in their neighborhood. So tell me, you know about the creation of that street pavement and who did that and what was the problem? I mean,
that we were outspoken outside living our lives. Like, they just wanted to destroy what they were doing down there. Like, it wasn't, and I think that's part of the, like, I hate that it happened because they should have been able to say what they were saying in peace and have it exist as intended. But also I'm glad it happened because it showed that people would still get mad about us living in peace and expressing ourselves. And so then right there, that's the moment right where it comes in. And then more and more people start to pay attention, because if it had just like been a mural on the ground until whatever said date, it'd have just happened and we'd have went on about our lives. We'd all like kept casting our, were we getting stimulus checks at that time? But you know, we'd have just went on about our day, it'd have happened and we'd have moved on. But because there was interference, it like sparked something like, I feel like that's bigger than, right, there's like a movement, especially in the Indianapolis area, to have more black art and to be more visible, more, even more outspoken than that, and to have it continue past, like, you know, that very specific moment of like pandemic and civil unrest, and have it go forward, because then you saw that there's a need for even more of this. Like, if they don't even want us to do this in this time, then we have to keep at it. It can't just be like us protesting this moment. It has to be a more concerted effort to always be visible, always be at the forefront, and hopefully get to like exist as ourselves, so that we don't have to like be black artists. We can just be artists, but we gotta go through some stuff to like get there. Like, I would love to just be existing as myself out here on the planet, but it seems nearly impossible to not talk about the fact that I am of African American descent all the time. Like if I don't go ahead and say it, somebody's gonna ask me about it, so I might as well just go ahead and like not make it my tagline, but go ahead and just like address it in the work or like as I go on existing.
Do they have fairs or something where black artists all get together to exhibit? That's what that is.
Hold on.
These, oh, this they right got here. Jackets. The Letterman
Art Fair. Yeah.
And when is it? It's here in Indianapolis.
Yes, yes.
I've never heard of it.
So the Black Art Fair is ran by Gang Gang, a cultural firm that developed here. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, you got it.
I didn't know they had Letterman jackets, or else I'd have been even more thirsty to be in this show. Letterman's are a thing that we're into.
I missed it this year, I suppose.
Yeah.
So it's ran by Gang Gang?
Yes, a black cultural firm that developed here a couple years back.
Black cultural firm?
And they basically, and you should look into them, because they do more than just this fine art fair that's for black artists. That is a big emphasis as well. So the biggest thing for them is the Black Fine Art Fair. And this started in 2021. I was in the show this year, 2023, to show three self-portraits that I did, along with 59 other artists. There's another artist that was in the show just on the other one of the other tables here. I think he's table one. And it is it's an art gallery that's been hosted at the Stutz Building all 3 years now. It's only gotten better every year. It's a huge event.
It gets bigger and bigger.
Let me tell you something. There is a VIP night, the very first night.
Preview night. I got to go this year.
It's insane. It was very big. And preview night is interesting because all the art collectors and investors come in, and those are the people who are buying the art out at first.
Yeah.
So that was the most I'd ever sold my art ever. And it was insane. They own, like, they're a relative of someone who owns like all the Simon Malls, and it's like it's huge that like somebody with that name would come and, yeah, I want your art. And she was initially like gonna only buy one. She's like, no, I want all three. Like, that changed my whole world. And like,
what?
And that's just Aren't one person. Right? Yeah,
yeah,
that's just one person.
When
like,
is this fit?
So it happens, it like kind of like late summer every year. It's already happened. Labor Day weekend. And it was, yeah, it was just, you know, when you said that, like, you had better times when you were, like, living through segregation, and it was, I felt like a community, I felt love. That's, like, how
just
that.
Just being in your, with your people. Mm-hmm. That's. Being with your artists, being with fellow artists, just being with, yeah.
Besides, yeah, yeah. Besides the segregation portion of it, like, it is all love when you go there. Like, you feel very, like, a part of everything that's happening. And there's people of all walks there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's huge. And I think, like, the biggest thing to take away from that is that we can have something like this. A black fine art fair. Black art fairs are one thing. But, like, a fine art fair, like, it's professionally, like, a gallery that a team of people have put together, and artwork, black art, sold for thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands. Yeah, like, it's insane. So, I'm definitely going to see you there next year. That's what's going to happen.
Oh, yeah, I'm giving you my card. I want you guys' information, because as I said, I wear many hats. I'm an anchor for a radio show in Bloomington called Bring It On, Four in a Black People in Bloomington need to know about you guys. They need to worry about that thing. So I can do you individually, or have set maybe the three of you on at the same time to talk about art.
And I wanted to talk about the earlier question of who could be. Maybe not.
We've got three minutes.
Okay, who could be at the table? And I think it may be a bit of a larger context, if you will, because I was recently in Cleveland, Ohio, at the Cleveland Art Museum. They had some gallery openings because they had a new director, brought by Brooke Minto, and she's from the East Coast. She spoke on it. There being a regional sort of connection. I think regional is Columbus, Cleveland, Chicago, Indianapolis, Cincinnati.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely.
So it's even though we're in India, when I go to Chicago, I have an art gallery in Chicago. It's not just within the city, but really nice to be able to interact and engage with, you know, other locations that are really tuned to your culture.
Agreed.
All right, I'm going to jump in, interrupt everybody.
Yeah, we're ready.
And we are done.